home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening, good evening. It is Rob Watson, and this is Rated LGBT Radio. Tonight, I've got tons of special treats tonight, one of which is my guest co-host, Brody Levesque, is here. Good evening, Brody.
Good evening, Rob.
And I'm really excited. I love what I do because, and you're spoiled because you've been in the know and finger on the pulse, and you have a contact list that is nobody's business. So you're always talking to very important people, but I love reading a book, sending it down, and then turning right over and having a conversation with the author. It's one of the most fun things in the world.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot of fun. I enjoy that very much.
Yeah. So tonight, we have on, or we're going to have on, she's waiting on deck, Major Margaret Witt, who was very well known for having confronted Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And she has written a book that will be coming out called, ironically, not so ironically, I'm sure they intended this way, Tell. So she is going to tell, and she did. And I loved it. I thought it was fascinating. It, for me, it was much more on a personal level than I had anticipated. I don't know about you.
I think the thing about the book to me was having been a reporter and following the narrative all the way through with the different bits and pieces, starting with, the removal process itself, even before that, some of the trauma that the service people were going through, the feeling of elation when Defense Secretary Gates and Admiral Mullins appeared in front of that Senate Armed Services Committee that day in February, and to hear what the Admiral had to say. And that was a significant event. And I think that, for Major Witt, Colonel Kammermeyer, and the others up there in Washington State, along with the other service members scattered across the rest of the U.S. military and the defense establishment, this was something that they'd all been waiting for. Yeah, the whole point was that, sexual orientation has absolutely no bearing on military capability, readiness, morale, lethality. It's almost the same argument that we're kind of hearing now with the trans ban. But I think the best thing to do is to let the major tell the story from her perspective, because for her, and anyone that's served in the uniform of the armed forces and in a career capacity such as, she did, it is so, so just deeply emotional to have that career threatened by something that is quite frankly so benign and a part of a person's very essence and being. And with that, I'll throw it back to you.
Yeah, and you made the best point of all, because rather than literally talking about her behind her back, something that I fear she probably is used to having had done in her life, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to talk in front of her front, and so we're going to welcome her onto the show. Major Margaret Witt, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for everything you've done. Thank you for everything you're going to do. Thank you for your book. Thank you for standing up. Thank you for being a hero for the country. Thank you for being a hero for the LGBT community. Have I left anything out?
You humble me.
No, it's an honor, truly, truly. As I was saying to Brody, first of all, how are you doing? How is life going for you right now?
Everything is great. I am very happy. Thank you.
What I mean, we're going to get to your book in a minute, but what does it feel like on the precipice of releasing your book, telling your very personal story around the kind of persecution that you experienced? And I know they're very different situations, but then to do that under this cloud of the transgender ban that has just come out, what is going through your mind as all that is happening?
Well, initially when it was going to come out, I'd say it was, you know, again, a very exposing experience, because I'm in general a very private person, but I'm actually very happy for the timing that it's coming out, because the ban of transgender service members just has me fired up all over again.
Thank you for being fired up about it, because it's Brody is in the thick of it. Now I understand you two have actually met before. Is that correct?
We have, and the major probably does not want to remember me. No. It was incredible. Major, if you'll remember, I interviewed you the night of the OutServe SDNL dinner. Aubrey introduced us.
Oh, and, yes, up on the balcony.
On the balcony. Okay, now you remember. And again, Major, it's an extreme honor to talk with you again, especially since it's been such a minute. It should come as no surprise to you that as we're working our way through this latest go-around with the transgender guidance, we're already having cases reported to the legal teams and to the LGBTQI movements that some commands are unilaterally taking action or attempting to take action, which is contrary and contravenes the explicit instructions of Defense Secretary Mattis. It should come as no surprise to you that if you're going to rate the services on, you know, best to worst, U.S. Air Force, once again, is at the top of the list, as I have personally been reached out to by Air Force personnel. And I want to ask you about that. It seems to me that there is an environment within the Air Force. It's within the culture. And of course, as you know, Major, the Air Academy, you know, sits right there at ground zero for the Christian evangelical and Christian right movement, literally right down the road on Academy Boulevard, you know, at Southgate. Looking at what happened to you, and we'll talk a little bit about that in your book, but looking at what happened to you and the culture of the Air Force then, let's talk about the culture of the Air Force now and the fact it doesn't look like much has changed. Would you agree or disagree with me on that?
I don't know that I can agree with that. I mean, the new head of the Air Force Academy, I believe, is a that's married and has a family.
The Commandant of Cadets, that's absolutely correct.
Yes.
I, speaking in generalized terms, I wasn't referring specifically to the academy.
Right,
so much
right.
As I
but
was.
I think that, you know, that I take that as a very good sign, considering the environment that she's in.
There have been issues with the Air Academy, as noted by some of the activist community, in terms of accusations of proselytizing and evangelical work, you know, in the cadet wing. But you know, the person that I talked to was an 18-year veteran of the Air Force and trans, and she's being forced. She's got 18 years in. She's only 2 years
away. Oh, my. Oh, my. I know exactly what that feels like.
Okay, well, let's go back to Don't Ask, Don't Tell for a minute. And I actually encouraged her to listen tonight, so hopefully she is. Let's talk about your experience. You talk about it a little bit in the book, but you know exactly what it's like. Can you kind of give us a feel for, you know, you're right there, and tell us what happened?
Tell you what happened, or tell you how it feels?
Little bit of both, probably.
We'll let them buy the book, but yeah, tell us about feels.
Well, to be, you know, perfectly good one day and a high performer and commended for your performance, and then the next day, because you've been given a label, is completely demoralizing. dehumanizing and to be invalidated like that. And to have someone say you're under investigation or to have someone tweet that you're no longer allowed to serve. I mean, the anxiety and the panic that sets in and all you want to do is serve. It's a very helpless feeling. You go into a panic, but you go into, at least I did, is like, what can I do? What can I do? And that's where I started, because all I wanted to do was serve. And I think Sergeant Schmidt over at what is now Joint Base Lewis McChord had mm-hmm. a great quote. You know, what she feels right now is determination and sense of duty. And that's what I felt. And I think that's what we all feel. But to have something like that happen to us is just really, it devalues you and it humiliates you. And you're all of a sudden the light now is shining on you and distracting, not by your own doing, distracting.
Right.
One of the things that stood out for me in your book that and maybe it was my interpretation reading into it, that there was almost like a slight edge of horror, even when you weren't, that big switch happened, but in the process of getting there, where you were essentially being kind of sexually harassed as people were like trying to sort of feel you out, pardon the expression, and you know test and
well,
see
yeah.
you know is she I mean that
it puts
I almost
you,
felt
it,
yeah it's like psychologically that constant
it's
pushing
constant
you.
Yeah, well, and it can be those folks pushing you or it can be perfectly innocent, but the fact is that we had to evade or lie, and I didn't want to lie, so it was always try to evade, and it just put you in a terrible position to where you were subject to those kinds of situations. And you know, a lot of us went through it's rather a type of military sexual trauma, because it's just over and over again that you know, you can't escape it.
The thing that I wanted to point out too was that, if you'll remember, Major, during his testimony in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee that winter day, the Admiral kept using the word integrity. When you were stuck in that position, did you feel as though there was a sense of loss of integrity, not necessessarily by yourself, but maybe by your command staff?
What situation are you speaking of?
Well, you know, you're having to deal with now having the label. You're having to deal with all that goes with that. And then, you know, my experience as a reporter obviously was different than yours being in the thick of it, but it seemed to me, particularly in a lot of the interviews that we were doing and talking to people, that there was an ongoing sense of lack of integrity of, you know, taking care of their own in a lot of these different commands. Did you feel that, you know, they kind of just left you out there adrift? That they, you know, that it just seems to me that there was that problem, or am I misreading that?
Well, in the not being able to say anything to anyone, to draw attention to an issue of maybe somebody harassing me or something, not being able to go anywhere with that is, I was put in that position by the law, and that was very frustrating. And I don't know if it was, I don't know what you mean by integrity on their part or my part.
No, and say I, you know, you wanted to serve.
Yeah,
that was the whole thing for you. I meant their part of command staff.
I totally get that from the narrative in your book. There are portions where you were literally, it felt like you were being stalked, and you were forced to go out on dates with these. It turned out to be an officer or an investigative officer, and put in compromising positions so that you weren't outed. And I just found that really abusive. And I totally get that was, you were in a position then where you couldn't even turn around and report it to anybody. Because
right,
that
I was told
would,
that
again,
to absolutely not share with anybody. But it was done on the premise that I was to be an informer for any kind of illegal drug activity because of where I worked in the hospital. And
right.
I don't know if, I would assume that was some sort of excuse just to intimidate me and into helping them in some way. And yeah, that made me angry. And yeah, I would say that is an integrity issue on their part.
Okay. The other question I've got actually is just germane to timing, Major. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you did retire in 2011, correct, ma'am?
Yes.
Okay. We're sitting almost in 2018. There's a little bit of time in between the two. Why now for the book?
It took me a while to convince myself to write it. It takes a while just for the process of finding an agent and getting it published. But it was in the process for quite some time. I worked with Tim Connor, who was amazing, spent a lot of years with me just going through it before we even broached agents to get it out. I just finally wanted to tell my story.
No, I understand that. It's, to be honest with you, Major, it's a very compelling story, and thank you for telling it, because it's the type of story that I think on a wider scale people really need to understand, just how policies like Don't Ask, Don't Tell, just like this transgender guidance that this administration has issued, that this type of discriminatory practices, because there's no other way of, you know, framing the context of this, just what they do to people. And at the end of the day, when you're trying to do a job and you're trying to execute the mission, it makes it very, very difficult. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, no, I have other timing questions. It's interesting we're on timing. I've got two kind of different timing questions. One was, you start the book with 9/11. I mean, the very beginning of the book is you waking up to the alarm and your experience of the morning of 9/11, and then you pick it up a little bit later in the book. What is the significance of 9/11 for your story?
9/11 for me, it was a big turning point time in my life personally for what was going on within my relationship and what happened in the world. And I think that everyone can relate to that feeling they had that morning. And I think that involves them initially in the story.
Well, one of the things that struck me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm just a lowly reader. It's like, know nothing. But the way the story came out to me was, because I believe you got deployed because of 9/11. Was that, did I read that correctly?
Correct.
That you were called. Yeah. So the thing that really struck me when 9/11 came up later in the book, because you start with it and it's sort of almost a little bit of mystery why, you know, here was 9/11, and then you kind of go back into sort of a flashback from there. But when it comes back up again, the thing that struck me was the juxtaposition of someone in our society who is living their life, who has this common shock with the rest of us of this attack of the country, but then whose life is, because of that attack, is like, okay, you're not going to do what you think you're going to do. This is what you're going to do now. You are going to serve. You are ours. You're out there and everything else. for someone who puts themselves in that position to be treated as you were for who you are later is unconscionable. And that juxtaposition for me, that's how it worked. Was that intended effect, or am I just bringing that to the party?
Yeah, no, it was to bring back the depth of the feeling of the timing of it and the meaning of being with my unit and being basically benched at the time that we needed nurses the most and that I had trained for over half my life. You know, my unit was actually activated as I was coming back from what was then Operation Enduring Freedom. We hadn't, you know, officially gone to war yet. So I was kind of left in that intermediate space, but then waiting to go back in to be with my fellow medics. And it was just such a tragic time to not be able to be there in my career.
Right. Well, and for no good reason, for absolutely no good reason. I mean, that's the insanity of don't ask, don't tell, of the trans ban. We have incredibly trained, competent people willing to do the hardest jobs in the world, and they're being stopped for no good reason.
Absolutely. And that's the disruption. That, if anything, is the disruption. These people are doing their jobs. They are dedicated to the service of our country. They have been doing their jobs. So to come in with something like this, well, at any time, but particularly now, and to call them a disruption to service or a threat to unit cohesion and morale for all things.
Mm-hmm.
That is just absolutely ludicrous. And for him to use unit cohesion and morale, you can't just, you know, just throw a label group of anyone and say, this is what they do. Just infuriates me. Just
yeah.
Because you put a label on them.
It's, I mean, it's bad enough that it's for no good reason, but when the reason used is the exact antithesis of what they're actually doing is mind-numbing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're creating
the
problem here. We were doing just fine.
Yeah, with that, one of the things that, and going back to the book she wrote, she was talking about U.S. District Judge Layton was set to announce on his verdict in Witt, the case, and 69 members of the U.S. Congress wrote a letter to the president. In the letter, and I'm quoting from the book, some of the most accomplished and lauded members of our military are gay. The letter reported in its third paragraph, Air Force Reserve Major Margaret Witt is one of those talented defenders of peace who has suffered at the hand of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. After 17 years of service to the United States Air Force, receiving regular recognition for her devotion and excellence, Major Witt was discharged after it was discovered that she was a lesbian. Her worth to the military and to the American people was outweighed by her sexual orientation. Her story is not uncommon, and neither is the unnecessary grief and hardship that is added to the shoulders of the gay and lesbian members of our military. Given that quote from that letter in September of 2010, and from what the major has just said, I don't see any difference between this experience that she went in September of 2010 and what some of the transgendered service personnel are experiencing now. I would like to also note, Major, that we've had 143 members of the Democratic caucus.
Right.
Write a similar letter. So,
yes, absolutely. I saw that.
Yeah. So I think in many ways, what I'd like to do, though, is just hold up the fact that your story, okay, as written and as even going back to that time period, is still very much applicable today. especially for these trans service people that are stuck in this awful, awful, you know, vortex.
Awful limbo, yeah. It's, yeah, vortex. It's good, yeah. Yeah, they don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I mean, it's just it's a terrible distraction on them when all they want to do is focus.
Well, I think the argument going back to, and you said it in the book, and you and I both know it from, you know, that time period, me as a reporter, and you, of course, as part of the court cases and so forth that Aubrey and them were working on. But I think that we all could agree that there was no foundational argument that could be upheld, even in court or just in common sense, for the arguments that the LGBTQI people could not uphold their end of the deal if they put the uniform on. It was ridiculous. And, you know, we're losing military personnel that the government of the United States has spent, in some cases, tens of thousands of dollars to train in their areas of speciality.
Yeah,
and some millions, absolutely major. And I think that this is part and parcel of it. And what you wrote in the book and how you phrased it, I think very much holds true and definitely does resonate with today in many of these points. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you guys are talking on that point, because I wanted to kind of jump even further back in the history. And this is a sort of an environmental question around the timing of the book. When you came out, when you were very young, and before you enlisted in or joined the military, you know, a friend of yours came out and was kicked out of his home by his parents. This happens in the beginning of the book, David. And then later, you know, through his hardship, he ends up becoming HIV positive, obviously in the time when that was a death sentence. And he passed away early on. And your whole telling of that part of your history made me very aware of kind of the silo experience that a lot of us had, where the secrecy of don't ask, don't tell, or it actually wasn't even don't ask, don't tell at that point. It was, you know, don't be at all.
Right.
Was something that was common ground. Because your hiddenness at that point in your life, I know I was experiencing in my life at the same time. And while amongst us was this epidemic where people we knew and loved were dying and everything else, and we would deal with that in our personal lives and then go home to parents that were oblivious to it and act like nothing was wrong. How much of that world were you experiencing when you did enlist, or, you know, were you kind of in a whole different place on that?
Well, I was stationed right outside of San Francisco when I first joined. And you compartmentalize, and I spent a lot of time up in the city, up in San Francisco, and was quietly active in everything I could be to, you know, be supportive of AIDS awareness. But you had to really keep it separate from your life. You know, nobody knew where I was going. Nobody knew what I was doing. Yeah, there was just a lot that people didn't know. My parents didn't know. My coworkers didn't know. Very, very much a silo effect.
Yeah. It's the one thing, there's all sorts of ironies in the don't ask, don't tell situation, which you've already brought out, and your experience. One of the ironies that struck me from your book was, you know, the story is, if we talk about your book publicly, we talk about how who you were disrupted your career and your, you know, your accolades of honor that you had rightly achieved, and who you were disrupted that. the thing that struck me reading your book was the kind of the other direction of how detrimental that secrecy and what you had to go through with that had on your personal life. You had a lot of tragedies that occurred because of that. Can you comment on that some?
Well, and there were a number of tragedies that aren't even in the book. I mean, I lost a lot of friends to suicide. I mean, you have your small group, your small support system that you just rely on each other. I think we all had it when we lived in such secrecy. You know, you develop your own small society that you just depend on each other, and it becomes kind of a small secret family. It was difficult, but the support that we had as a small community for one another was very, very strong.
Well, I'm talking about also, though, your romantic relationships, because wasn't one of them almost like a betrayer of you, ultimately?
Oh, yes. The cause for this? Yes. Yes. Yes.
Oh, her.
In the book, we talk about that. Yes. Because I didn't necessarily want to have a family. I didn't know how I was going to explain that to anyone. And when it came down to it, bottom line, I didn't want to, especially at my age, but I didn't know how I was going to explain that to parents I wasn't out to, how I was going to take care of a family where I could not acknowledge it within the military. It was difficult enough just even buying a house together. That I felt was almost too exposing for me. That made me nervous.
Yeah,
I don't think that people understand, you know, just how detailed that entire process is. And in defense of that, I would say, the military community is very insular, and by necessity of the job that they perform and just the culture of the military. And I think sometimes if for civilians looking into the U.S. military structure or any military structure for that matter, they tend to overlook that fact that, it's a very small community. And it's not, I'm sure if you started your career at Travis Air Force Base, then you kind of posted around the country. By the time you circled back to what's now Joint Base McChord, you probably encountered two or three people along the way that you guys had been posted together. You know, I have stopped at Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany several times, and it's amazing talking to some of the folks there, how many times it's been ships passing in the night or actual tours of duty together. And as a result, I think in many ways, and correct me if I'm wrong, Major, but that does actually amplify your being nervous about certain, aspects of especially during that time period. Would you agree?
Are you talking about people within your own community that you run across or people?
Your military community that you're running across. Yeah. Your colleagues, your coworkers, people in the command structures.
Yeah. I mean, but there was an advantage kind of in that underground gay community too, in that somebody would know somebody at the base you were going to. So you could immediately have somebody you could trust at that next base, that kind of community as well.
We actually
it's funny because I think there was, yeah, it's ironic because around that time, even in the civilian world, because I was young, I was in business and going to different cities, and people would connect me with other gay people the same way. I mean, it's sort of like, I was out in my small, tiny circle, but my coworkers I wasn't out to, and I wasn't out in other places. But they did the same thing. It's like, you know, call this guy. He'll show you around the city. You can kind of slip away from everybody else and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah. It's a comfort to have that under the circumstances.
I was also talking about, though, because I come from a military family. My dad was a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps. My mom was a military wife. I was a military brat, raised that way. And my friend Steve Snyder, who's written a book, he was the officer that got booed at the Republican debate.
Oh, yes.
Mitt Romney.
Right.
And his spouse, his husband, Joshua. And, with their story, that the spouse in the shadows was a big part of, all your significant others. It's like you're trying to hide, but they're really hidden. And
yes,
the stress of what they have to go through, because they're worried about you, and they can't visibly be there the way like the way my mom was for my dad, as part of that unit. It almost disrupts the culture.
Right. Yeah. Terribly hard on them. Terribly isolating.
What, from your vantage point, having been through all of this, and to Brody's point, we have transgender service members serving today that are facing different circumstances, but probably very similar feelings. What is your insight and advice to them?
I really like what Sergeant Smith said, and the determination and sense of duty, and to hang on to that. And you've always felt that you needed to be the better performer. At least I did, and many of my cohorts did. Just remember your mission, perform it well, hold your head high. We have your back. My heart goes out to them under the circumstances and under the current leadership. It goes out to all the service members, but especially goes out to my trans brothers and sisters. It's a terrible place to be. Lean on each other, look to support systems. I'm glad to see that some folks have filed suit. That's going to be difficult, particularly those on active duty. Look for your supports. And some people are going to come to you that you never expected and be supportive and be open to that too.
I think that's great. So,
let me back someplace for a minute on that, because she just made an interesting point. Major, if I may, let me take you back to December 2011. Senator Lieberman had said, and you quoted this in your book, there were a lot of things that enabled us to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But one was Major Witt's case, because of the effect it had on public opinion, because of the inequity of how she was treated. So let me extrapolate from that for just a second, if you'll just indulge me, Major. Looking at your trans brothers and sisters today, the fact that there are, in fact, court cases now filed, OutServe, SDNL, Little Glad, ACLU, and, of course, the National Center for Lesbian Rights. Do you think that public opinion will, in fact, have the same kind of impact on those cases that yours did back then? Will it be changed, do you think?
I do. I think public opinion will have a great deal of I think, positive effect, but also, our Democrats, especially in the House, have already, started working on a bill. Like with Senator Lieberman, he told me that particularly within the Senate, my case gave a human aspect to the issue. And, hopefully they'll see the same thing. And I think, as far as general population, mm-hmm. I think we've come a long way, and hopefully it's still a minority who are not in favor of this. And I think it's based purely in ignorance.
No, you're right. And it's the same minority. I would probably tell you that Elaine Donnelly, who you all know from the Don't Ask, Don't Tell fight, is back in the thick of this as well. Yeah, yeah. Our friends on the other side. But it just, I think the important thing is, and this is one of the things that I noticed from reading your book, is you never once deviated from the path of what you felt was right. And, you know, that was something I had spoken with Senator Lieberman right after the vote. And the senator told me that, and during that time period, obviously I'm going back to them, that he felt it was so necessary to have someone like you to be able to be cast as, you know, the public face of it. Do you think that we need to have that happen again with the trans cases?
Well, you know, I yes, and it will probably happen, you know, in a legal case, but I think it's already happening. It's already happened. Kristen, our Navy SEAL, you know,
right.
there are so many stories because they're allowed to serve now. They've been allowed to serve. There are many stories out there. There's a real human aspect to this. And if we can, you know, tamp down the rhetoric and the distractors and the hype on just grouping everyone under one label
it's a great point because it's like you see pictures of the transgender soldiers and you don't see transgender people, you see soldiers, and I think that has a huge impact.
Everyone is different.
Exactly.
Everyone is different and everyone has a different job and everyone comes from a different background. And they're just people.
Right. And
wanting
I think
to serve their country and excelling
exactly.
at it.
Well, one of them in particular, my favorite, is Air Force Staff Sergeant Ireland, who looks like John Cena, the wrestler, and his comment was just,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Just try to get me out of my Air Force.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
I've had his picture on my phone for a while.
Yeah, I mean,
he's
we're
an impressive young man,
yes.
Yeah. We're in the age of the meme, and fortunately, that message by just his image is the thing that is, you know, very clearly sends that signal. Major, what I wanted to ask you, though, Brody brought up a really great point about you always doing the right thing. What in all of your heroic endeavors is first you set out to do the right thing by serving in the first place and in your job in what you were doing as you were serving and then fighting the injustice that was done to you. Of all of the things that you've done, what are you the most proud?
You know, I'd like to say that I'm very proud of the law that we've established that will help so many people. I'm very, very proud of that. But, you know, the thing that means the most to me, and I'm most proud of the people that I'm surrounded by and that I served with. And I think if I wanted, what I'd want to be remembered for would be that I'm kind.
I will tell you from my experience at the dinner that night in Washington, virtually everyone told me that, Major, from Victor to Aubrey to you name it. That was the thing that if there was any word that encapsulated you, Major, it was kind. So, yeah, I think that was very well established. So,
I think it's a very underrated quality, and I think more people should have it.
I think that is an understatement right now in our current climate. If you could teach kindness to the public discourse that is happening in our country right now, that would put us a light year ahead of where we are.
It's not hard.
Yeah. So, Major, the flip side of what I was asking, though, what would you do differently from looking back, and hindsight's 2020, and we all have it, and if you could walk back some things in that you've written about in the book, what would you do differently now?
What would I do differently? Well, that's a tough one, because when things are happening, I generally measure them pretty heavily. I probably would not. I would have stood more firm in saying no and playing the game of actually trying to date some people I shouldn't have. in male perspective.
Right. No, those sounds like hitting.
Although there were some I did date, you know, seriously, but that was a whole different story because I couldn't be honest with them either, so I couldn't really explore that avenue. So.
Yeah, I think those are – I don't know that we ever get a crystal ball on those decisions, because I think as we're exploring even just ourselves, that it's very confusing. especially even when you are not in a situation where you're going to lose your life and your livelihood over it, it's very confusing. So I can't even imagine under the circumstances you were. I want to do some little housekeeping stuff because this is important, but your book is coming out. When is it coming out? Where can people get it? Who's going to be in the movie? You know, all those important facts.
It comes out October 3rd, and it's available. You can order through any of your regular book sites, including Amazon, bookstores. Shout out to Tim Connor, who helped me write it. He was amazing. Who's going to play me in the movie? That information is top secret right now.
Oh, that makes it sound like you've got somebody already.
Somebody
optioned this one. That didn't take. Okay, that's good. I wanted to hear that.
I have to warn you. Yeah, Brody is probably one of the best investigative reporters around, so he may be in trouble. This one may be. We just put the red meat in front of him. So
no, no. Just a big tease out there to you, Brody. Just a big tease.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's talk about now these days. So we're writing books. What else are we doing?
Since I've been in the reserves, I've always worked full time anyway. But I recently, 3 years ago now, moved to Portland, Oregon. And I transferred from the VA in Spokane to the VA in Portland, Oregon. And I'm a supervisory physical therapist with the Portland VA.
Well, outstanding. I happen to have Rob Young Max, who has been a guest on the show, as a photographer. He's a 21-year-old Ukrainian-American. He lives across the river from you in Vancouver, Washington. So, and I love Portland. I love your big, huge bookstore in Portland. That's like one of my favorite places.
Oh, yeah, Powell. I'll be there on the 15th, by the way.
Oh, there's the plug. Okay.
15th of October, pal.
15th. Okay. There's the plug for it. Okay. We're going to do, I'm just curious. Have you talked to Rachel's crew all these years later about going back on that, Al, and talking about the book? Or
I would.
Are we doing for publicity?
Absolutely love to go back and talk to Rachel. And this time I wouldn't look like I was going to pop on the screen like I did the day of my decision.
You were a little out of sorts.
I would love another chance. And that would be a dream come true. So if you know anybody, you work on that, Brody.
Okay, well,
you would be
definitely
surprised.
Going to pass the word along.
yeah, that phrase, "Do you know somebody, Brody?" is, is there is a lot to that phrase. Let's put it that way. So,
which reminds me, I have a congratulations, well done, looking forward to the book from the executive director of OutServe, Service Men's Legal Defense Network, Matt Thorne. I knew I was coming on tonight to speak with you, Major, and Matt sends his best from Washington.
Thank you so much. Tell Matt, thank you for the good work.
I will be more than happy to do that. And Sue Fulton also sends her greetings as well. So,
love Sue.
Okay, well, there you
trying
go.
Trying to keep greetings. Up with her. She's a tough one, man. She's a busy lady.
I wouldn't even try. Sue is like a force of nature. That's
yes,
very painful.
Yes, she is. She's fantastic.
Even I know better.
So how wide are your book tours going to go? Where are you signing?
I'm just doing a Northwest kind of local tour, Idaho, Oregon, Washington. So I'll go from Seattle to Moscow, to Spokane, Portland, Kirkland, Lakewood.
What is the most interesting sort of conversation with somebody from the other side you've had since you've had this experience? Have you gotten any conversations where somebody has voiced the kind of anti don't ask, don't tell, or wants it back, or doesn't think gay people should serve conversation?
You know, I don't think anybody's had the guts to kind of approach me with that directly. You'd think I'd remember that, so I don't think that's actually happened to me.
That's probably smart on their part.
Well, I take it back. I did have one experience. It was a patient at the VA that was pretty angry that I even existed. Yeah, but my staff was amazing. They stood up for me right away.
No, that's good, because I've just noticed that this has come up a lot of times on the campaign trail, where different conservative politicians have run into vets that, it's been a little bit more the other way, that the politicians stepped in it not knowing who they were about to talk to, and the vet has let them know in certain terms their position as being unacceptable. Major, what do you think of the military hierarchy right now under Trump and what is happening there? Kind of sidestepping even the ban and don't ask, don't tell, just the military situation and chain of command right now. Are we in trouble?
You know, if I was still serving, I'd be very anxious. I'd want to have faith in the leadership and the generals. You heard General Mattis saying, hold the line.
Mm-hmm.
And, I remember even saying that under Bush, it was hang on.
Right.
Hang on, just, do your job, hang on. But, with all that's going on, right now in all over the world, they've got to be anxious and it's a bit nerve wracking, and you've got to have faith in that leadership that they will do the right thing.
Very, very well said. We are.
Well, I know
actually,
that there's a phrase that is often used, but I'm going to use it. I don't see it as cheesy, but Major Witt, thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you.
I would echo that and echo thank you for your service. Thank you for your activism. Thank you for always doing the right thing, and thank you for your kindness. I think the full dimensions you bring to this are outstanding. Literally
it's all
down
about
to
taking
our,
care of each other. Take care of each
well,
other.
Not everybody's in a position to, and you have been, and you did. And that's really important. And I mean, I think that's part of the earmark of heroism is standing up in the opportunity and doing the right thing. We're down to our last 5 minutes. What haven't Brody or I asked you, and I realize we've grilled you with stuff, but what have we not asked you that we should have asked you?
You know, probably I wonder, you know, will the law that my case made really help these lawsuits that are going on now? And I have to believe that it will. And I hold out hope that it helps in some way.
I would say the lawsuit, and I'm not a legal expert, so, and Brody is probably much more versed on that, on the legal specifics that will help. But the thing that I can tell you that does help is you. Because what you did, standing up, being a person, putting her life out there, saying, this is my life, this is what happened to me, this is unjust, and letting the whole world get to know you and understand the situation from that perspective. And that's what we were talking about. That's what our transgender service members are doing now. That will help. That will make it happen more than anything that can happen in a courtroom.
As so many that came before me as well, and those that are standing up now. Yeah, it makes a difference. And, you know, for some of the folks, they felt like it didn't work out their way. But, you know, it all matters, and it all plays a part in our history and you know, in bending that arc towards justice.
I think you're absolutely correct. I think that's, you know, from at least my perspective as a journalist and having watched this, I'm really thinking that maybe this time it will make a difference, and maybe this time we'll finally see an exit strategy, if you will, and that at the end of that exit strategy, there'll be a uniform treatment of all service personnel, regardless of, you know, ethnicity, religious, racial characteristics, gender identity, or sexual orientation. At least that's my hope.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Major Witt, last question, and I'm going to let you close us off with this. When people close your book, they finish reading the last page, what do you want them to remember?
Stand up for what you believe in. Speak out.
And
everybody has a story.
There you have it. Thank you so much for coming on with me and Brody. And it's been a pleasure and an honor. And I know I've hidden it well, but I admire you so well and so much. So thank you for everything you've done. Brody, I can't even the same for you with all your work and your brilliance, you're bringing to everything, and you are way, way in this fight for transgender rights. So,
Thank you, Major.
Thank you both so much.
So good to hear from you again.
You too, as well, Brody. Thank you.
And Major Witt, you know I'm not done with you because you are going to be guest on my other show out in Santa Cruz, but that will be closer to your book release. We're setting that up right now, so I can't wait to talk to you again. Yay. And
Yay.
For our listeners, thank you for listening. You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. That is Thursday nights at 7 p.m. here on Blog Talk Radio. Out in Santa Cruz can be heard Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Pacific time. Both times are Pacific time. That is on www.ksco.com. You can live stream there. If you're in the Northern California area, you can hear it on AM 1080 or FM 104.1. My name is Rob Watson. I'm really grateful for your time and your brain cells and your passion. Go out and express it, make us proud, and come back next week. Thanks for listening.